This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Turmeric Liposome Complex, a natural solution to chronic pain. Future Farm's liquid turmeric with liposomes and nanotechnology delivers maximum absorption for effective pain relief. Sourced and manufactured in the United States, this product contains 1,600 milligrams of curcumin and powerful antioxidant properties. This plant-based curcumin is used to possibly reduce inflammation, block proteins that trigger swelling, and intercept inflammatory pathways, significantly decreasing inflammatory responses. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Don't live with pain when there's an all-natural, science-based remedy that works without adverse side effects. Get free shipping on all of your orders at myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're going to take a deep dive on the cancer world because our guest is one of my favorite go-to experts on the subject. I've actually interviewed him several times over many decades. I might have interviewed him early on, as early as the 1980s. Because he's been on the cancer scene for a long time. He's medical writer Ralph Moss, PhD, and he's written or edited 12 books and 4 film documentaries on questions related to cancer research and treatment. He is the former science writer and assistant director of public affairs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York in the 1970s. He worked in the belly of the beast. Essentially hired to promote advances in cancer research and treatment. But since then, he's taken somewhat of a critical view, independently evaluating the claims of conventional as well as non-conventional cancer treatments all over the world. And he is also the editor and chief of the Moss Reports. We're going to talk a little bit about that. That's a very, very important research for cancer patients who are baffled at the profusion of alternatives that sometimes confront them when they deal with this very, very scary disease. So his new book, just out, is Cancer Incorporated. In 1980, he read a book called The Cancer Industry. So he's been on the cancer scene for a long time. And Ralph, you know, it's an exciting time in the world of cancer research and treatments. Breakthroughs, so to speak, are being heralded almost daily. We seem to be closing in on cancer with precision medicine. But there's a lot of controversy because some of these therapies come at great cost, render patients very sick with side effects, and maybe not as effective as they've been touted. So, you know, give us the inside story on this. What is your book highlighting?
Yeah, so I think the most startling thing for me was realizing to what degree the oncology profession, that's to say the leading lights of cancer treatment, have been undermined and corrupted by the pharmaceutical industry. So I started the book, it was going to be like a brief report on the clinical trials and whether one should go into clinical, consider going into clinical trials if you have cancer, and what are the pitfalls of the clinical trials. And I had sort of a spiel that I had worked up over, you know, 40 years about this, and I had a kind of thought I had a kind of nuanced view. What I discovered was that there is a government database that shows how much money individual doctors are getting from pharmaceutical companies, and the money is broken out not only by year, but also by what the purpose of the money is. So you see some doctors are getting vast sums of money from drug companies, not just to do studies on the products of the industry, but just in their pocket, just for their own personal use. And sometimes those doctors are the same doctors who are issuing grandiose proclamations to the public and to the medical profession on the effectiveness of the drugs of those companies.
Would you say that in effect that there's, to put it mildly, a conflict of interest or perverse incentives to introduce spectacular new supposedly breakthrough therapies that can be very expensive, lucrative for the doctors, maybe showing some marginal benefits for patients, but not what they're cracked up to be?
Yes, absolutely. I would even go further and say that when somebody takes personal money, I mean money for their own, just for their own private use, and is then testing a drug or a treatment from the same company or the same group that's giving them the money, then they're putting themselves in great moral risk, and it looks like bribery, basically. And
let's call it what it is, right?
Yeah. And so this came to a head about 2 years ago, when the physician in chief at Memorial Sloan Kettering, my alma mater in New York, he was found to be taking $3 million in money from drug companies, and then touting those products just to a ludicrous degree, and it wound up on the front page of the New York Times, and the CEO of Memorial Sloan Kettering demanded his resignation, and he resigned. He later wound up as the vice president and chief of cancer research for a giant pharmaceutical company, and he's more comfortable.
The revolving door really works.
Absolutely. Revolving door between the research community and the so-called dark side of big pharma. And, but, you know, the attention of the world momentarily was focused on this one instance of somebody taking a huge sum of money from the company whose products he was supposedly evaluating and then touting. So this was my breakthrough moment in terms of this book, when I looked at this government website, Open Payments, it's called, Open Payment Data, and I realized, I mean, this is just hiding in plain sight. And yet I didn't know about it, and I would say that 99 out of 100 people don't know about this. And yet there it is, for all to see. Now, I would say there are circumstances in which it is justified to take, for doctors and for researchers to take money from drug companies, but that would mostly be if there's no other way for them to do the research. Sometimes their institution has to take the money. It's a perverse system, because the drug companies basically get to evaluate their own products, which is kind of crazy. And FDA, it plays a very passive role in this, and actually loses more and more credibility every day. And so there are still tremendous flaws in the clinical testing system. But what really, really got me going was the fact that people were just taking, doctors and, you know, oncologists in particular, just taking vast sums of money to come out with statements and so forth that the drug company wanted. Now, getting back to my original focus, which was the clinical trial system, of course, we know clinical trials have a very sordid history. There were a lot of human experimentation done in the guise of clinical trials, and I'm not just talking about Nazi, horrors of concentration camps, but I mean in the United States, the Tuskegee experiment, where African American men with syphilis were basically withheld antibiotic treatment that would have cured them for the sake of the completing the experiment, and many died. Just as martyrs to science without even knowing that was going on. So I'd say we have a very, very bad history when it comes to clinical trials. But what's really important is that most clinical trials of cancer drugs do not measure things of benefit to patients. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure this sounds crazy. I mean, why do the trial, right, if mm-hmm. it's not going to benefit the patient? But what benefits patients in cancer is it's one of three things. First of all, cure, of course. If you can cure the disease, outright cure. That's very rare. Second thing would be an increase in the overall survival. When I say overall survival, I mean the actual time mm-hmm. that people live in the aggregate. Right.
So we're not talking, for example, I mean, we have instances where people survive a cancer but then succumb to the debilitation that's caused by the treatment, and their life span is not extended. And then, you know, you're probably going to talk a little bit about quality of life, too, as part of this.
Right. So what they usually are measuring when they tell you that, and you have to drill down when you're studying these things, because they'll say that the drug increased survival, they don't usually mean survival by the dictionary definition or by the average person or even what the average physician would think survival mean. To us, survival is the same as overall survival, meaning you actually on average, the patients in the study would have lived months and years longer than if they hadn't taken the drug. That's not at all what they mean by survival. Most times they mean progression-free survival or relapse-free survival. In other words, a period of time during which they can't measure the disease being present or progressing for the patient. But if two people get the same treatment, one of them the treatment delays the progression of the disease by, let's say, 6 months, but that patient dies a year after starting the treatment. The second patient doesn't have any change in the progression. They just go downhill, and they also die 1 year after starting the treatment. This gets registered as a success for the drug because they're saying that, look, in the patient number one, they got the drug, they had progression-free survival. Yes, but they didn't live any longer.
They also measure response on the basis of regression, cancer regression.
Yes.
You know, that there's,
they
use the word response, or they use the word regression. And you actually have drugs that are being approved on that basis. And these drugs are very, very potent drugs with a lot of side effects are extremely expensive, that cost maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they will produce a response demonstrably. Yes. But how does that translate to well-being of the patient?
It doesn't. I mean, in most cases, it doesn't. You can have a response. A response is a shrinkage of tumor. So if you can shrink the tumor burden by 30%, that's considered a success. But does the response actually correlate with increased survival? It usually doesn't. It may or it may not. But they're so focused on the size of the tumor. But the tumor is made up of many different kinds of cells, and shrinking it, I mean, in some respects, you're also shrinking the white blood cells that are trying to kill the cancer. So it's a little bit like Vietnam, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. Mm-hmm. So yes, you can destroy the tumor, but you have
defoliation with Agent Orange,
strategies
like carpet bombing and so on.
Yeah. Right. Right, but it doesn't correlate with in many cases, it doesn't correlate with actually increased overall survival. So there's a shell game going on because they're telling you, oh, this drug actually increases survival. It doesn't increase survival. They're telling you we got a response, but the response doesn't necessarily correlate with any actual patient benefit. And then, you know, you have the side effects, which you've mentioned, which can be mild or can be terrible, horrendous, or even result in death. And there's a ways to fudge that also, because only if the person dies within 30 days of the time that they complete the treatment, does that get considered to be a treatment death. But, you know, you could affect somebody's kidneys or liver with a drug and they could die a year later or 2 years later, doesn't usually get chalked up mm-hmm. to an effect of the drug.
Or as an indirect effect, you can have patients who are treated aggressively for prostate cancer, sometimes with hormonal therapies, and the cancer is arrested, but these men, in their 70s or 80s, completely lose their mojo. They become flabby, frail, devitalized, and then they die of cardiovascular disease in an accelerated fashion. That's, I think, been well demonstrated.
Yes. Yeah, something that many of us are very aware of the possibility of that. I had prostate cancer myself, as you know, and I avoided all surgery and radiation, and just was treated with cryoablation, which is a relatively mild outpatient procedure to destroy the tumors with a cold mm-hmm. probes, mm-hmm. and I think the results are very much better when you do that, and you avoid the worst side effects of the conventional treatment.
And that brings up an issue, because do patients necessarily get access to the best therapies, or is it just kind of cookie cutter? And do patients really have to take the initiative to question established protocols and maybe find their own path, as you did, seeking, a therapy that's maybe a little off the main menu?
Yes, I believe the latter. My main job is that I run the scientific side of Moss reports, which are detailed reports on both conventional and complementary and alternative treatments for about 30 different kinds of cancer. So we keep these, maintain these, keep them up to date, and really try to drill down so people can have an unbiased view of what it is that the conventional treatment will do for or to them, and also how good is the basis on which one could recommend alternative type of treatments. I'd say with prostate, I got very lucky because there was a hospital in New York, NYU Langone, to give them an unsolicited plug, where the doctors practiced cryoablation and were willing to treat me, even though my tumors were considered to be high risk. They were willing to treat me for my condition with, as I say, coming up on 5 years now for me with excellent mm-hmm. results. So
it was a little off label. In other words, it wasn't like the cookbook therapy for your stage and type of cancer. So, but it was thought that under the circumstances, this might be a more conservative approach, less devastating to you and perhaps as effective.
Right. I mean, Medicare covered it and FDA has approved it. It's just that the general medical community, the urology community, considers it still to be experimental, although it's been in use since cryoablation has been in use since 1859. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, getting more and more sophisticated, but amazingly, it was demonstrated at the great Crystal Palace exhibit in London in 1859. Wow. So it's been around, but it just hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves. So, I think that's one example out of many of so-called alternative treatments that are really have great potential, but never get explored and adequately tested, funded, because they don't have the same economic value mm-hmm. to industry that that some of these other treatments have. And I'm focused on this money aspect of cancer. I have been for 40 years since I wrote Cancer Syndrome and Cancer Industry in the 1980s. I've been focused on this because I think that gets overlooked. People think that there is that treatments are decided based upon the effect, safety and effectiveness of the treatment. There's another filter they have to pass through. Yep. They have to make money for a big corporation. That's really what it's about. And the profits to be had, especially with the new targeted drugs, so-called precision drugs, immunotherapy drugs, is phenomenal. These drugs are now selling on average for $150,000 mm-hmm. per per patient.
Yeah, you know, it's really weird. I mean, sometimes I'm watching, you know, cable news and I'll see an ad for Keytruda. Keytruda is an immunotherapy drug that's used, I believe, for lung cancer and certain other cancers, but you have to have a certain, you know, genetic component to the cancer to make it kind of lock and key. But I'm thinking, like, you know, here I am. I'm just, like, minding my own business. I don't have cancer. They're showing me this ad. Like, how many people out there actually fit the criteria for Keytruda? You know, what, maybe, you know, 1 million people, 2 million people are watching this broadcast. Maybe there's like 6 or 8 or 10, but the profits are so great as to justify running this ad for a very niche thing. You know, we're not talking about, you know, Charmin, you know, toilet paper, or, you know, selling Oreo cookies, something that everybody, you know, would use. So, but it's interesting that, there it's is phenomenal. So much money to be made that they run these very niched ads for, you know, like, my goodness, I don't have lung cancer. I don't need this.
Keytruda, last year, the sales on Keytruda was $8.8 billion for that one drug. And that's because they can charge $150,000 up to $1 million for immune therapy. If you use combination of drugs over a period of time, it can come to $1 million. There's one drug, it's a unusual kind of drug. It's called Kymriah. It's what's called, it's a type of immune therapy. And they're charging $475,000 for one infusion of the drug. And Carl June at University of Pennsylvania, who developed the drug, has written that the actual cost to the company of this drug is $20,000. I don't know whether he's exaggerating or not, but if you think they, that's about 5%, that's like a 95% markup. Okay. If between 20,000, and that would be, it's extremely unusual because that drug has to be, it's a kind of vaccine that has to be made up individually for the patient.
Yeah. It's a custom.
Most drugs.
Yeah. Custom immunotherapy.
Have a very, very, absolutely, but CAR-T cell therapy, they call that. But most drugs are just spit out of a machine, you know, and the markup, I mean, to get from an inexpensive medication to $150,000 per patient, and there, and it's probably a few bucks for them to produce it. And then, of course, the research, and they would say, well, we have to do all this research in order to make the drug. Yes, but most of the research is done by at the taxpayer's expense. So most of the actual research is done at
the NIH. Right, exactly.
Or people, the NIH is paying in different laboratories. So we pay twice. We're gouged twice. First, we have to pay for the doing of the research. Secondly, the research is then exploited by the drug company. And then we pay again these phenomenal prices, all because of one provision in one bill from about 20 years ago, where they snuck this through literally in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. They called an emergency meeting of the Senate and they passed this bill with this provision that said that the government could not negotiate with the drug companies over the price of drugs, that Medicare, Medicaid, VA can't negotiate. That one provision, the 3 a.m. provision, passed by one vote, and because of that, that's worth untold billions of dollars to the drug industry to get that pushed through. And the drug industry maintains somewhere between 1,300 and 1,500 lobbyists full-time in Washington, just the drug industry. And so they've got about three lobbyists per congressperson. And they lean on and they're bribing these Congress people with, and you can look at a different database to see how much the Congress people are being paid. Of course, I mean, yes, it's a lot of money, but it's a tiny fraction of what it's worth to the drug industry to basically corrupt the government in this way. And that's why, you know, we're in a terrible state, terrible mess, really, when it comes to our medical system, but especially when it comes to cancer.
It's a real cost driver. You're book in 1980 was entitled The Cancer Industry. Now the current book is Cancer Incorporated.
Yeah.
Is this a different book than what you might have written 30 or 40 years ago? And, you know, surely, we've been engaged in the so-called war on cancer. It was declared by Richard Nixon back in, yes, I guess, the 70s. And, right, you know, our research and treatment of cancer has been portrayed as a steady, persistent series of advances. Yeah. The immunotherapy and CAR T cell therapy, these are touted as being the decisive breakthroughs in our war against cancer. Are they being oversold?
Yes. Well, it's complicated. So immunotherapy is my great hope in terms of cancer treatment. I mean, I have a number of hopes, but that in particular, because the first immunotherapy, which was invented in New York for cancer, which was invented in New York City, at what's now Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, was the mixed bacterial vaccine of William B. Coley. Mm-hmm. And he started
these toxins.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he started in the early 1890s. He went on until the mid 1930s. His son Brad picked that up, and he went on until 1963. So basically, they were giving the Coley's toxins from essentially 1893 until 1963. So for 70 years, this was given legally. It was listed as a standard drug. It was enormously effective, considering the times and considering how advanced the cases were, how desperate some of these cases were. It's the great untold story. And my son Ben and my grandson Jacob and I have worked for the last year and a half on a film. We have a documentary film coming out called Immunotherapy, The Battle Within. It's the battle within the person between the cancer and the immune system. It's also the battle within the field of immunotherapy between the low cost of fever therapy of William B. Coley.
Which is not really patentable. I mean, it's not, you know,
correct.
You can't really harness a profit potential for something
And the company that was producing the Coley's toxins up until a few years ago gave up because they couldn't come up with a couple of million dollars to do a good manufacturing process plant to make the toxins. Remember I said that the competing immunotherapy, meaning Keytruda, the immune checkpoint inhibitor, made $8.8 billion in sales last year, and this company making Coley's toxins couldn't come up with one ten-thousandth that amount of money to support the Coley's toxins, for the simple reason that anybody with a good education in microbiology can make it. I had a researcher tell me she could make it in her sleep. the cost of Coley's, to provide Coley's toxins, even today, for a patient, per patient, would be no more than $2,500.
It's like bathtub gin, kind of, you know, just follow
right,
the recipe.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have to be, you have to follow the knowledge that the people who made this, starting in the early part of the 20th century, they knew how to make it. We have certain formulas that Martha Tracy developed at New York Hospital. She made the outstanding formulation, she and her mentor, so that we know how to make these. We as a society know how to make these things.
But there's no commercial imperative. You know, like, how are you going to get it? A, how are you going to characterize it? How is it going to be accepted by you? Because they don't really like to approve, you know, kind of mixed biologicals that are poorly characterized. They like to characterize molecules that you can put in a safe and patent and, you know, you're off to the races. We got to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts, but we're in a fascinating discussion with an expert in the field of cancer since 1977. Ralph Moss has been empowering cancer patients with the Moss Reports. He's been an observer on the cancer scene, and he's a critic of both conventional and certain alternative practices alike. He's an equal opportunity critic because we need that, you know, someone who is not incentivized monetarily to promote one or another therapy, but can critically evaluate them in an objective fashion. That's what he does in his book, Cancer Incorporated. It's a new book just out. We'll continue our discussion in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.